Hey, so have you heard the rumor that the restaurant guys are introducing a call-in component to the show? Well, guess what? It's true. So if you have a question for the restaurant guys or something you'd like us to discuss on the air, call us at 732-828-9459. Call anytime from anywhere. We'll answer your questions and, who knows, maybe even have you on one of our upcoming Restaurant Guys call-in shows. The number to call is 732-828-9459, 732-828-9459 from anytime or anywhere.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathy Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very, very well. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm all right. I want to... Now, you have four kids. I have none.
Mm-hmm.
Your kids
are awesome.
They are awesome. They are awesome. When you go to a restaurant, are they enticed at all by, and this is relevant for a reason we'll get into in a moment, are your kids enticed at all by the toys that are sometimes given with fast food restaurants or collectible cups or things like that? Are they drawn to those restaurants?
My children will occasionally choose a restaurant because of what is there.
The toy.
Though usually the food, usually, you know, they'll choose something that has something breakfasty or something sweet as opposed to something, you know, if we're talking about fast food, which we are.
Where do your kids hear about the toy?
On TV, of course.
And they will, I'm just curious because I don't have this experience. How does it come up? I mean, you're driving by and you say, hey, kids, let's go out for fast food.
In the rare occasions that we go out for fast food as a family, occasionally, you know, my wife will be out somewhere and just need to stop and
but
on the rare occasion that we go for fast food, frankly, if there's a plan and I'm going to be home, we generally don't go out to fast food because I don't care for it that much.
Right.
But if we're not home, then the kids will be looking for, we'll call it a special treat, though that's not really what I think it is, but the kids will be looking for a special treat and they'll say, hey, can we go to McDonald's, Burger King, whatever. One of the other issues, by the way, besides toys, that becomes a factor here.
Yeah.
Is how good is the play place? Is also a factor.
Oh.
The play place. As a matter of fact, my wife just mentioned this today about a place that's got a really good play place, so the kids like to go there and meet their friends there as a place to eat, like Chuck E. Cheese, for instance.
Right.
My kids never choose Chuck E. Cheese for the pizza. It's awful. They choose Chuck E. Cheese because you're in an amusement park, basically, an amusement hall.
But as far as the toys are concerned,
mm-hmm.
is it like at home, like when they're thinking, hey, Mom, let's go here, and it's because they want the thing that they've seen on TV? Is it that blatant, or is it more subtle than that?
No, I think for the most part, what I see in my family
mm-hmm.
is I see the kids don't even necessarily, most of the time, now every once in a while there'll be some super special toy that they want, but most of the time my kids aren't tracking what the toy is.
Mm-hmm.
But they will say, okay, this place has good toys, this place doesn't, and the toy will be a factor in the decision into which place they want to go.
Hmm. Well, this brings us to our discussion of a recent decision by, in California County, Santa Clara County in California. They took the controversial step of banning toys, banning restaurants from offering toys with high-calorie meals. It says, let's see what we have here. It says, it's the first of its kind. It restricts the fast food restaurant's marketing strategy of using toys to entice children to buy high fat, high sugar, and high calorie meals. The board of supervisors president is a man named Ken Yeager, who says this ordinance breaks the link between unhealthy food and prizes. It imposes common sense nutrition on meals linked to toys. We hope that other municipalities, counties, and states will follow suit. The ordinance applies only in unincorporated parts of Santa Clara County, a largely suburban region south of San Francisco, and county officials say there are just 50 restaurants that this will affect. This is from AOL News. We should quote where I just read from. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it goes back to something we've been talking about for years. And is it okay to market directly to children?
Mm.
And I believe it is not okay to market directly to children. And when you put a toy inside the whatever happy meal or whatever joyous meal you're going to bring to the child, that it's not about the food. It affects their food decisions. It definitely does. Okay, because,
well, I mean, advertising.
If one meal gets a prize, let me put it this way. Okay, if three of my kids are going to one of those places, and two of them get a prize and one of them doesn't get a prize, it's going to be a problem.
Right.
So even if it doesn't affect their decision, it may affect my decision.
Right, right. Because you have to point out to Sarah that, are you sure you want that? Are you sure you don't want to supersize that and
exactly.
get a, and get a milkshake
exactly.
you don't want? Or you won't get a toy.
Exactly.
You know, that's really a great illustration of what we're talking about here, of those who are in favor of this ban. There are those who think it's an intrusion on, and many of our colleagues in the restaurant business would think it was really an intrusion on restaurants' freedoms. The measure was strongly opposed, this is again from AL News, by fast food franchise operators and restaurant owners who fear the idea might spread to other jurisdictions. Dozens of opponents attended the meeting and applauded loudly when their representative spoke. And here's a quote from Amalia Camoro, a government director for the California Restaurant Association. We do agree that there is a childhood obesity problem. Hey, great, Amalia. That's really great. thanks for going. That's amazing.
You are paying attention.
Wow.
Good for you.
Now, here she says, getting rid of the toys is going to do nothing to solve this problem. And you believe that because...
I don't believe it. I think that it's one of the steps. Here's why they have a problem. They have a problem because getting rid of the toys will lower their sales, and that's a true story. That's
but,
a true statement.
But
the
hold
reason
on
they
ha-
the,
Let-
hold on. The reason they have a problem with this, with all of this legislation, is because what they know is taking the toys out of the meals is going to reduce their sales.
Well, and much more is the only place that it's going to reduce their sales is it's going to reduce their sales to small children who would be enticed by a little piece of plastic garbage. So not even a good toy. Like,
well, even a 12-year-old is enticed by a little piece of trash.
Okay. So, but what they know is it's going to reduce their sales to children. So what she says is this will do nothing. Getting rid of the toys is going to do nothing to solve the problem. However, the children are obese. The children eat too many calories. A lot of their calories come from these high-calorie foods. They will sell less of them to children who are obese. Selling less high-calorie, high-fat food to obese kids does just not sound like a bad idea. How can you say it's not going to have an effect?
Let's turn this on its head. Okay, let's forget about the marketing to children aspect that we mentioned a minute ago. If you take those very same toys and you put them into the more healthy foods, I'm curious, into the foods that would not normally be chosen by the children, I'm curious as to whether or not you'd have the children choosing the more healthy foods for the toy or the less healthy foods without the toy.
See, I think that you have a problem here. The more healthy foods, when we have kids who are acclimatized to processed sugary foods full of flavors that are designed to appeal to, you know, candy tastes better than carrots to kids and to me, to be honest with
mm-hmm.
you. Now, there is the perfect carrot at Blue Hill, but most carrots don't taste that good. Okay?
Right.
So it's a combination of candy, of toys and sugar and fat and all that stuff. There was a study done recently. I wish I could quote it, but there was a study done recently about a comprehensive study. This has always been assumed, but it was only recently the study was done on food sold by cartoon characters. So they had a bunch of small children, and they had the same foods, the same breakfast cereals that were packaged exactly the same, and they did blind tests, taste tests with these kids. And the food that was represented, that was associated by the testers with these cartoon characters, tasted much, much better, according to these children, than food that was not. They did the same experiment with carrots. No difference. Okay, you can have Bugs Bunny sell the carrots if you want, but the kid still, he knows they're carrots.
Popeye's been plugging spinach for a long time.
Yeah,
not doing
any good. But, you know, this does bring up issues of freedom of speech and freedom to do business. But I think you really hit the point earlier on. Now here, let's talk about what this ordinance does. It doesn't say they're gonna ban toys. What it says is, if you're going to offer a free toy with a meal,
It sets a limit of 120 calories for a beverage, 200 calories for any single food item, and 485 calories for a meal if it comes with a toy. So what you're saying is the meal can account for no more than a quarter of your kid's daily caloric intake. That's a meal.
Well, if you said a third, I would say, you know, is it your big meal of the day? Is it even at 40%, I think I would be comfortable with saying, okay, this is our big meal of the day. This is 40% of your calories, 40% of your calories. But it shouldn't be 120% of your calories on a given day.
And I think we need to address the freedom of speech, freedom to do business arguments, because I think those arguments have merit, and I see where people are coming with that.
Sure, right. People in our industry.
Except that I think you really hit the nail on the head. Advertising until, I think it was the 70s, advertising directly to children was banned. By the way, that's about when the obesity epidemic started to attack our children. Look, there are lots of factors for the obesity epidemic. But advertising directly to children was not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? We don't allow, I mean, historically, we don't allow commerce between adults and children unmitigated by their parents. We don't allow adults to directly market to our children. That's creepy.
It is creepy. You know, there's one other part of this, or actually not part of this, but kind of adjacent story that we need to talk about. Okay, McDonald's has to recall 2 million glasses because there's cadmium in the Shrek glasses that you sold to people. Oh my God!
Yeah,
like somebody. I bet 100 people at McDonald's lost their job because of that particular.
I don't know. You know, if you bought it from a reputable, the problem is you buy stuff from China and you're told you buy it as cheaply as you can buy it, and mm-hmm. China supplies it, and it's like maybe a company they've dealt with a lot.
But you talk about cheap toys. Okay, so basically this was an advertising campaign aimed at children, and there's cadmium in the glasses above toxic levels.
Yeah, and that was bad stuff. But at least that was unintentional. This is what we're talking about is intentional. You know, let me read for just 1 second. From Kevin Katilla was heated. This is at the meeting. Here, Stephen Hazel, who brought one of his own favorite toys to show the board, says he collects them and sends them to children in the Philippines. He called Supervisor Yeager Head Grinch Ken Yeager and angrily asked, "Do you want to be the one who bans toys?"
Toys?
Okay, look.
Toys? No more toys! I'm the Burgermeister Meisterburger!
Now, if they gave you a toy with some sort of medicine, don't you think that'd be wrong? If they gave you a toy with cigarettes,
right,
wouldn't that be wrong? I mean, you know, here's the deal. Let me read. Kevin Catello was also heated. "I take this personally that you're trying to take away our freedom of choice," he said. "Parents have enough good information without you having to legislate this. You're going to deprive little kids of a toy." Ken, that toy's worth a buck. Buy your kid a toy for a buck.
Well, you know, one of the things that these places have done, and I have to say I think is a move in the right direction at the very least, you can now in some of these places at some of these restaurants just buy the toy. So if your kid's really just jonesing for the toy, and you can just go in and say, "Here's my $3, I'll take the toy. I don't want your stinking meal. I'll take the salad with the apples."
I like that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, not all of them, but some of them you can do that now.
Well, here's the problem with the guys you're taking away our freedom of choice. If this advertising were directed at parents,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you have a right to make choices for your kids. But this is directed at your kid so that your kid nags you to death to do something. You know what? Kids don't have a freedom of choice.
Right.
Okay? They shouldn't have a freedom of choice.
They better not.
It's our job as a society and government has a role for regulating what's in the public sphere. Maybe you're okay with your kid growing up in a nudist camp, but the public says, you know what, for adults to see other adults nude is fine, but a lot of parents don't want their kids to be raised in with naked bodies everywhere, and they don't want them to see the private parts of the opposite gender until they're old enough to handle it. And so we have laws that don't let you go nude in the mall. That's just... And it's primarily because of kids, I think, because we protect our children. Because certain things are appropriate only for adults, and those things are directed at adults and constricted to adults. I just
I think this is, I know, and we're going to get some Restaurant Association flack on this. I know the National Restaurant Association is against this, but we shouldn't be advertising to children. We can be advertising to adults about what's best or not for our children, but we shouldn't be advertising to children. Of course, I'm not going to do anything to change it, but I'm all in favor of this law.
Hopefully we are doing something to change it.
Yeah, well, I'm curious to see if this stands up to state review. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And our guest today is Anna Sophia Joannis. Her movie is Fresh, the movie. It's a compelling documentary about the state of food production today.
Anna, we loved your film. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I thought it was great that this was a comedy about food. No, I'm kidding. It's a very serious documentary about the state of food production today. And if you had to sum up for our listeners, by the way, you can find out where to go see Fresh and link directly to the movie site at restaurantguysradio.com. You tell a rather compelling and we deal with issues like this a lot, and not all the stories are as optimistic as yours. I think a hopeful, or maybe optimistic, but at the very least a hopeful review of the state of food production in the West today. Is that fair?
Oh yeah, that's absolutely fair. And you know, I think it's interesting because I often think of optimistic and pessimistic as being equally righteous. You know, it's kind of this feeling that we know what the future holds, and I think that, you know, as much as you may feel that you're informed, we really don't know what the future holds. But I think it is certainly hopeful, and I think hopefulness is a necessary component of life. And I think that we are so bombarded with doom and gloom stories these days that it's very hard to feel to regain this feeling of hopefulness. And so Fresh is very much about inspiring and connecting people with stories of change. You know, yes, our current food system is incredibly absurd and flawed, but people are all over the country and all over the world are hard at work changing it, and Fresh is really about celebrating these stories and connecting the audience with them.
Anna, in one way, we do know exactly what the future holds. What we know is that it can't stay the way it is.
That's absolutely true.
It's got to change in one way or another.
Yes.
Well, why don't we talk for the listeners who haven't yet seen your documentary about some of the things that you point out in your film that really do need to change?
Sure.
What?
Where would you like to start? Where would you like to start?
Well, I think we can start at the beginning of the film. I think a rather compelling interview that you do that's a little ambivalent if you're not immersed in food issues, as Mark and I tend to be, is the interview that you do with the chicken farmers who
Mr. and Mrs. Fox, as you call them,
who are rather somewhat content with the model of agriculture under which they're operating, where they're using very what is erroneously called conventional farming methods to raise chickens with a lot of antibiotics and in rather confined circumstances, and they seem to be rather okay with it. And you certainly paint them in a very sympathetic light. And you know, for Mark and for me watching the show, there were sort of alarm bells that went off in our head when we watched them be interviewed. And I think by the end of the film, you show some of the compromised position in which they are economically, and maybe some alternatives to the way they're raising food and perhaps some of the things that they're oblivious to. Why don't we talk about that first interview? I think it was a great way to start the film.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, I think that what's so powerful about this this footage and this interview with Mr. and Mrs. Fox is that, you know, you see, first of all, firsthand how confined, you know, you see these almost 30,000 chicken being literally dumped into a house, a chicken house. And it's hard to really call this, you know, farming. It's really literally warehousing of chicken in the most confined possible environment. And what I think, you know, you probably recall from the imaging in the movie, I kind of show these images really close to images of you know, kind of industrial processes like creating, pouring, bottling, you know, processes that make sense when they're made in such a large scale. You know, like why would you, you know, make 10 plastic bottles at a time or 10 Coke bottles at a time? You know, you want to make hundreds of thousands at once. But chickens are living animals. They're life. You know, they're not a widget. And so I think that what's scary about the industrial agriculture is that we've taken industrial processes, which have been really good for us, and we've taken them where they don't belong, dealing with life forms. And so I think that's the first element. It's a very almost commonsensical or ethical part of the movie. It's like, you know, we do like industrialism. We're not saying let's go back to the day of our grandparents, but are we sure we want to treat animals the way we treat bottles? You know, does that make sense? Then the other part of it is Mr. and Mrs. Fox, when I asked them what they use in their feed, because these chickens are bred to grow really, really fast. And everything about the way they're raised is meant to just get them to fatten up as fast as possible. So I asked them what's in their feed, because they mentioned they get really good feed, and they don't know. But they do know that there's some antibiotic in their feed. And one thing that most of us are not aware of is that antibiotics in the industrial food system are used in a two-fold way, not to treat sick animals, because that's a totally acceptable way.
And logical.
And logical way, exactly. But it's used to increase growth in animal, because believe it or not, when you give a low-level antibiotic on a daily basis to animal, they grow faster for whatever reason, and also to fight potential disease, because when you put animals in such confined environments, they're going to get sick. So, you know, in order to prevent illnesses to develop and literally exterminate your herd, because, you know, if there's, again, so close together, if one animal gets sick, they might all get sick. It's kind of like, you know, your kids at the kindergarten, right? Once one kid gets the flu, you can be sure that all of the kids are going to get it. Or
well, let's take this back a moment and just realize what the juxtaposition is in traditional agriculture, what I will call traditional agriculture, what, you know, agriculture before industrialization. You didn't have 2,400 chickens or 2,400 pigs on one farm, and you didn't have, you know, 20,000 chickens on one farm.
Right.
It wasn't that intense, and so, you know, nature sort of took care of it's only because we put these chickens in terribly unhealthy environments and you know it's unhealthy because without antibiotics they couldn't survive.
Well,
that's the absurdity. Mm-hmm.
The other issue you have here, of course, is all the children in a kindergarten classroom don't have exactly the same genetics like you do at a factory pig
right,
farm.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So
and we haven't genetically modified the children so that they actually have no immune system left to them. A lot of the animals that we're breeding today are only bred to grow fast, and so they are really not very resistant animal. And so you have to kind of raise them in this completely sanitized environment and worry about any kind of bacteria entering that environment, because it could wipe your herd. So it's and what happens, so like there's again so many elements, and later on in the movie we meet as you know Russ Kremer, who's a hog farmer who had this really scary experience where, you know, he got sick from one of his hogs with an antibiotic resistant infection.
One of the hogs had tusked him in the leg,
exactly.
You know, and he just kept working.
And
it was just a flesh wound.
Yeah, and he almost died. Like, he tried every single antibiotic in the market, and they ended up putting him in the hospital with an IV of a new antibiotic, which saved his life. But he could have died. And, you know, what we're seeing with antibiotic resistance all over the country is that when you start giving antibiotic on a daily basis to animals, a new form of bacteria develops, which are resistant to the antibiotics that we're giving them. So we're creating a situation that in order for these companies to make a little bit more profit, we're losing one of the most amazing things that happened in the history of medicine, which is antibiotics. And that's really scary. And we're developing stronger and stronger and stronger bacteria. E. coli is so deadly today because of the way we confine cattle and the way we feed them and the way we feed them antibiotics. So E. coli never used to be such a deadly bacteria, and today it is, and every year people die.
And
so we really have a sick system in place.
And people don't realize that, you know, E. coli, before we started fattening cattle on grain lots and modern agricultural practices that are used for fattening and slaughtering cattle, E. coli wasn't a particularly nasty bug for human beings. It didn't really cross the barrier very well because, well, there are a lot of reasons why, because cows have naturally alkaline stomachs and we have acid stomachs, and we change that. And we have the
acidity of the cattle stomach by feeding them grain, which they're not supposed to eat at such a high percentage of their diet. So that is absolutely fascinating.
And here's what happens in nature. If a cow's stomach becomes acidic, that cow doesn't do well and dies. But we keep that cow alive forever. So we keep that cow alive because it's in our interest to get that cow to market. And we have this unnatural thing that creates unintended consequences, like the virulent form of E. coli that makes kids sick and
makes adults sick too.
And kills people.
I want to just go back to your initial question about the foxes, because what is really powerful, as you mentioned, by the end of the movie, you realize that the foxes are really just peon in a much bigger game, and they're stuck. They don't have a choice of how they raise chicken. There's only one company in their area that will provide them with chicks and then provide them with a feed and then pick up the chicken for processing at the end of their growth. And so they don't have a choice, and they're forced actually to enter contract, 7 years contract, where they have no power to really negotiate the term of the contract. So they're not really choosing at all any part of their farming operation. And so I think that the issue is really with, how consolidated our farming system is. And, you know, it's funny, it's interesting to me that, you know, obviously we're starting this conversation with, you know, well, what's going on with our system, right? Like, how absurd is it? And it's so easy to just go on and on and on and say, like, you know, how bad things are, and which is why it was so important to me that, like, you know, although we do establish, you know, a lot of these things in fresh, that we move beyond that and that we start showing people what the alternative is. Because the alternative is really beautiful, right? You know, the opening images of fresh is Joel Salatin, the Virginia farmer that was made famous by Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore Dilemma. The opening shots are him, you know, opening the gate to his pigs and calling on them, you know, in this just absolutely idyllic place. So I think it's important to realize that as bad as things are, there are really, really great alternatives that are beyond anything I think most of us who are not farmers know about.
Well, I think the whole point of putting those two stories next to each other is that what we want is our independent farmers to actually be independent. That's, if you're working for the chicken factory and you're just a cog in the chicken factory, you're not independent at all. But if you run a family farm, you can be independent.
Well, and I just want to, you know, there's this myth of the free market and that we can't interfere on a policy level in the free market with food. Free market with food doesn't work. And we don't have one. It may work. I don't think it works, but we don't have one. So for instance, when you talk about the foxes, there's only one chicken processor in the whole area that if they don't sign with, they're out of business because there's nobody else they can deal with. And that chicken processor delivers them chicks, stipulates the inputs they have to use and the methods they have to use and the buildings they have to use to raise those chicks, and then buys the finished chickens and butchers them. And there's only one place to get chicks, and there's only one place to sell chicks, and they don't have the infrastructure or the ability, because it is so concentrated, to do anything else. So they look like independent farmers, but they're really not, you know?
Yeah, and I think that the consolidation, which is what you're talking about, the fact that there are so few companies that really control our food from seed to plate, this year, the Labor Department is actually investigating this, because we've had antitrust laws in the book for a very long time, but we're not enforcing them. And so finally, the Department of Labor is looking into this issue, and we just had a petition on Fresh the Movie on the website, because what we want is for the Labor Department to not only investigate, but to really act on this. Because as you mentioned, we really don't have any sort of competition in the food system, and we need to reestablish some real competition so that farmers have a choice and so that consumers have a choice.
In the movie, I think Michael Pollan makes a great point when he says there are four companies, soon to be three, producing 83% of all the beef in the country. That's insane. That's amazing. I mean,
so if you're a beef farmer,
it's an amazing statistic. You have very, very little avenues in which to travel.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting? In New Jersey, where I know you guys are from, there has been a growth in a local processing plant, and so it's happening. You know, on the one hand, we are. One of the hardest things for independent farmers and for consumers who are interested in buying meat that's been treated properly in their life and handled properly at the processing level, it can be quite a challenge because of this incredible consolidation. But there is now a growth of local processing plants, and there is a need for all kinds of infrastructure and for all kinds of investment to make this possible, but it is happening.
Well, and I want to take that up on the break. On the other side, I do want to talk about the movie. Your movie is very hopeful, and it points to a number of things that are actually happening in the world and people that are changing the paradigm, and we really need to cheer for them and know about them. And we'll be back to talk about that in just a moment with Anna Sophia Joannes. Her movie is Fresh. You can find out about it at www.freshthemovie.com. We'll, of course, link there from our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking with Anna Sophia Joannes. Her movie is Fresh, and it's about the food system in America and what's wrong with it is what we've been talking about for the first segment of the show. But it is a hopeful movie, and you detail a lot about how things are changing right now, how a number of farmers have had enough. And you know what's really striking in your movie is how intelligent the people have to be on the other side of things, that the people that are making things better, whether it's from the farm or from the marketing or from the grocery standpoint, these are people that are really forward-looking, smart people. Can you talk to us about what's changing in the positive direction?
Oh, sure. And I agree. Like, I what has been so incredibly amazing in traveling across the U.S. and meeting all of these wonderful farmers and chefs and activists and consumers is just as you mentioned, what visions these people hold. You know, it's and you know, I'm a believer that in order to change something that you don't like, you can't just say I don't like this and I'm going to react against it. You have to start imagining what the alternative would look like. And this is what's so fascinating about the sustainable food movement or the real food movement, is that it is incredibly forward-looking. It has a vision that is really beautiful. And I think that, you know, when I was choosing the people that were going to be in the movie and choosing what to portray about them, because, you know, again, I'm portraying just the tip of the iceberg of what these people are doing and what their vision is about, I was really interested in saying, well, you know, all of us or we hear the word sustainable thrown around a lot. And usually it's in contrast to saying something is not sustainable, which means that, you know, we can no longer continue in that way, that it is going to have to stop, right? What we talked about a little bit at the beginning of the show, you know, we have no more oil soon, so we can't have a system that relies on oil. We losing soil at such a rate that we soon won't have enough soil to grow. We're polluting our water so fast. You know, what's going to happen when that also becomes a crisis? So that's kind of like the part that's unsustainable. But what is sustainability? And I think that, you know, you can try to explain it in words or concepts, but when you see it, it really, it's one of those dot moments, you know, like, of course, that makes so much sense. And it's when a farmer shows you how everything is interconnected, right? How every animal, plant, sun, water, how everything fits together. Everything has a role in this kind of beautiful web of life. And then you understand that, like, sustainability is kind of a circle. You know, it's a circle, a web. It's a really interconnected system versus this very linear, extraction and then dumping way of the industrial world. And then once you have that vision in your mind, once you have it not in a kind of conceptual way, but once you've seen it, experienced it by looking at the way these farmers operate, then you can recognize it for yourself. So that the conversation that I often hear about, well, what's better, organic or local, all of these kind of conversation, free range versus grass fed versus, you know, then you can answer them yourself because you really have like a deep understanding of what sustainability is about, and you can interpret that for yourself, you know.
And I think that your film really brings out some great points that a lot of folks don't understand. And I think a lot of folks who listen to our show really, we deal with these issues, you know, occasionally and regularly and have for many years. But I think that there are some basic stuff pointed out in your film. And one of the things that's very clear and simple is the juxtaposition of an economically viable, sustainable farm today – where we have animals and we have crops. And we show how when you have animals and crops on a farm, you know, the animals can eat the waste products of the crops, in other words, the parts of the crops that you can't sell and make money on. And then what comes out of the animal can then fertilize the land to make more crops. And you have this closed circle of, like, and the birds follow the cows and pick the fly larvae out of the cow dung, and then we get eggs from the birds, and everything has a role to play.
Michael Pollan talks about the nutrient cycle.
And that nutrient cycle is broken up when we do factory farming, when we say, okay, we're going to take 20,000 pigs and put them on this farm, and we're going to take 20,000 chickens and put them on that farm 10 miles away, and we're going to grow only corn for 20 square miles down here.
Yeah.
What you have is you have a plant system where there's refuse that has to be dealt with that would normally just go back into the land, but now you have a pollution problem, you have a toxic waste problem, and certainly in pig and poultry operations, you have these lagoons of manure, and we think, oh, well, it's just manure. Well, you know, manure is what, if in low concentrations and when there's not the stuff put in it, goes back to giving nutrients to the soil. Well, when it's in such high concentration, it is just a toxic waste that needs to be dealt with and has no use.
Yeah.
And pointing that out in your film, the juxtaposition between what can work and what does work and is sustainable and makes sense, as opposed to what doesn't, is truly striking.
Well, yeah, you know, again, we've used this idea of industrialism where, you know, you specialize and you create, you know, so like one factory only does the cap of the bottle, the other factory does the body of the bottle, and the, you know, the third process is to fill up the bottle and close, you know, the bottle with a cap. So it's like you on purpose specialize because everything is mechanized, and it makes sense, right? And so we've taken this principle and we've taken the animals out of the farm and we've segregated them in one place, and as you mentioned, that leads to all kinds of problems. You know, what do you do with all of this concentrated manure? What do you do in order to get enough water enough food to feed them? So you have a bunch of problems that need to be dealt with. And then on the farm where you need to grow food, mostly in monoculture, so grow crops in monoculture, you're dealing with how do you fertilize the soil now that the animals are gone? Because as you mentioned, the animal manure is the best fertilizer. So what do? So you have to bring in chemical fertilizer that end up washing off and polluting our river and creating a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So, and then because you're raising a monoculture, meaning only one kind of crop, you also have diseases, so you have to start using pesticides. So what we've done in this industrial agriculture is that we've created a bunch of problems that we then deal with, mostly with chemicals, pesticides, antibiotics, et cetera. But we don't deal with all of them. A lot of them end up just being caused that you and I don't necessarily see up front, cost to the environment, cost to our health. cost to the workers, cost to the animals, kind of the hidden cost, or not so hidden anymore, cost of the industrial system. And as you mentioned, a big part of what sustainable agriculture is to reintegrate animal and crops into one beautiful cycle of nutrients. And this is definitely what all of the farmers that I portray in the movie, that's what they're doing in a very different way, but they're all trying to mimic nature and to make sure that everything kind of expresses its own nature. You know, like the line from Joel Salatin that he wants chicken to express their chickenness.
Right.
You know, he could have said that he wants grass to express his grassness and tomatoes to express their tomatoness. It's kind of understanding that all of us and everything on Earth has kind of a place, a role to play, and if we respect that, things do fall into place.
Well, and you know, I finally want to deal with, I mean, people need to go and see this movie because it deals with a whole lot more than we're going to be able to cover on this radio. But I think it's important on this one radio program. But it's important, I think, your movie deals also with people on the retail end. You deal with how this comes to market in a very sustainable way that people seem to value. And one of the things that we always talk about is we have come across over the years, Mark and I have been in the restaurant business for 17 years and doing this show for 5, and very often ideas will come up that make a lot of sense in that they can, you know, we can grow a sustainable crop this way, or we can create this cafe, and you know, Mark and I do a bunch of restaurant consulting, and we'll say, you know, that cafe is going to go out of business. You know, that's not going to work. And if the business that's trying to promote sustainable agriculture doesn't stay in business, if it's not sustainable from an economic standpoint, it really can't accomplish anything long term. You also deal with getting this food to market and the independent grocer. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there's so many layers or levels to what you just mentioned, and I think one of them is us, the consumers. And I think that once you start understanding the process of growing food and you start really understanding the consequences, a positive one, of supporting local farmers, supporting the restaurants that actually buy mostly local or sustainable food, supporting the co-ops or the local grocery store that really provide you with the best food. Once we understand that, we really become one of the sentences in the movie, we vote with our dollars, which is true, but we really increase the demand for this food, and we make it possible for farmers to stay on their land and to continue growing food in that way. And we slowly allow more and more farmers to switch and to grow food in that way as well. So the consequences are enormous. But right now, you know, as vibrant as the alternative food system is, it's still incredibly small. I think we are at maybe 2% of the whole food market, the food market, not a whole food market.
Yeah, right. We got it.
So, sorry about that. But so 2% is minimal, it's still a niche market and therefore more expensive as well. And it's focused really on CSAs, farmers markets, some co-ops, and then great restaurants that are, you know, a very, very strong force in many communities because they have a much higher purchasing power. And yet all of that is not enough. And so what I portrayed in Kansas City is a supermarket owner who partnered up with a co-op of farmers, and by doing so is providing his customer with a farmer's market every day of the week in his grocery store, in his locally owned, family-owned supermarket, which is, you know, it's very rare these days in Walmart-controlled America. So, and it's just one model. I was just saying, look, we need this food to be accessible, available at a much, much more mainstream level. You know, all of us cannot go to the farmer's market. All of us are not interested in being part of a CSA. We need this system to move on to the next level of distribution. And one way is that this food should be in a supermarket. And one way to do that is to make sure that consumer requests it. And the second part is for farmers to kind of join together in co-op so that they can have enough supply to actually reach the volume necessary for you know, something like a supermarket. So this was just an example of how this could happen. And I think a lot of us are feeling that we do like the convenience. You know, there's not only negative about the convenience. There's some really great things about that. And I think that we need this local alternative food system to move on to that more, to that volume.
Well, Anna, you talked about people having respect for nature and respect for the ecosystem, and I really believe and I really hope that your film will help people gain that respect for the system and how it should work and how it can work.
Thank you so much.
You should see the film. You can find out more about it at freshthemovie.com. We'll link to it, of course, at restaurantguysradio.com. It's coming to a theater near you, and you need to check it out. Anna Sophia Joannis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
And you'll be back. Stick with us. We'll be back with the Restaurant Guys in just a moment. We're on WCTCAM and restaurantguysradio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. I'm in awe of that movie, and the movie was great.
One of the most important things I think that the movie showed was a hopefulness, was a solution. Here's something that works. Here's something that we can move towards. And maybe it's not perfect, and maybe it won't work in every scenario, but here's something we can work towards. When someone comes into my office, when an employee comes into my office to talk about an issue of any sort.
Which office is yours?
Our office.
Okay. I thought half of that office was mine.
When an employee comes into our office, talk to us about any issue, no matter how big, how small, and how it affects the restaurant, they're not allowed to come into that office to talk about that issue until they have at least a proposal for some type of solution. And I just think that's really important when people are talking, because a lot of people just vent. And a lot of people just vent about, here's the problem, here's the problem,
I don't think it's fair the way we assign side work at the end of the night. It's totally acceptable as long as it comes along with, and I think we should change it in the following manner.
Absolutely.
But I don't think it's fair.
And so often we deal with that in any business, in whatever you're looking at, you know, whether you're working in an office building or whether you're working on a farm. I really don't think it matters that much. I think that people who come to the table with some solution to their problem are much more powerful than people who come to the table with just an issue.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this movie shows some potential solutions. And I think Anna was very clear that these are not going to work in every place. These are not going to work for every farm. These are not going to work in every market. But they're things to consider. But we need to, okay, it can't be just consumer-based. It needs to – we need the government to pay attention to it. There are food disparagement laws on the books. There are – in some states, it's illegal to take a picture of livestock because the state government is so much in the pocket of the big agribusiness lobbyists that they know you'll be horrified if you see what the food looks like. So we need to act individually, we need to act in concert, we need to talk to our government to get our government at least out of the way of protecting the wrong way of doing things and open up the channels for the right way of doing things. Would you agree with that?
Sure. Could I disagree? Is there anybody who's listening who would disagree?
All right, Francis and his high horse are going to get out of the radio station right now and go back to running a restaurant. Hope that you've all enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.